Welcome to Neurosalience, the OHBM podcast.
Welcome to the Organization for Human Brain Mapping Neurosalience podcast. I'm Peter Banditini, and here I discuss brain imaging and modeling with scientists from around the world. Today, I'm excited to have Alex Huth on the podcast. Alex is one of the more creative and insightful people in the field of brain imaging today, as he's been forging new ground using naturalistic stimuli and voxelwise models to create intricate maps of semantic features across large swaths of the brain. His seminal 2016 paper in Nature brought his approach to prominence. Alex received his bachelor's in engineering and applied science from Caltech, where he was also working as an undergraduate researcher in Christoph Koch's lab. He continued on, receiving his PhD in 2013 from the University of California, Berkeley, Helen Wills Neuroscience Institute, under the guidance of Drs. Koch and Jack Glant. He went on to do his postdoc in the Glant lab and finally moved to the University of Austin in 2017, where he is currently an assistant professor in computer science and neuroscience. It was truly a pleasure to talk with him as we covered a wide range of topics and a lot of ground, both in depth and from 30,000 feet. And I hope you enjoy this discussion. Okay, welcome to the OHBM Neurosalience podcast. I'm Peter Banditini, and I'm with Alex Huth. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Peter. It's great to talk to you.
Yeah, so I was mentioning just before the podcast that I've had your previous postdoc supervisor, Jack Glant, on a couple of times, and you know, the work that you're doing that I became aware of, now it's been at least 10 years ago, or maybe almost 10 years ago, has been just stunning. It's among the things that has captured my attention, not only from the methodology standpoint and the cleverness by which you handle naturalistic stimuli, but also from the implications from these, you know, semantic maps, these wide swaths of semantic organization that I can just stare at for hours as far as that's concerned.
Me too.
I'm sure you have. So before we get into that and all the other work that you've been doing, continuing on that, I'd just like to just talk a little bit. You know, a lot of the listeners like to hear the background, the human side of the researchers, and you know, just to start with the beginning. You know, so you don't have to go too far back, but as far back as you want to. You know, what first got you interested in either brain imaging or computation or whatever, and where to go from there?
Yeah. So before starting college, I think the thing that really got me was AI. I was really interested in AI and thinking machines. What would it take to make a machine that actually thinks like humans? So this was 2003-ish when I started undergrad, and it sort of quickly became apparent as I learned more about how things actually worked in the world and what, you know, what was going on in the world of AI, that it was not a terrifically good time maybe to be you know, trying to just straight up build thinking machines. So I really got grabbed then by neuroscience as kind of a backdoor way into AI, if you will, that it's like, you know, if we don't really know how to build machines that can think, why don't we look at brains? Why don't we figure out how brains work? And if we can do that, then we should be able to imitate that with machines. So I think one thing too, I saw a lecture really early on when I was a freshman in college by Mark Konishi, who was a neurophysiologist, auditory researcher at Caltech. He just died recently, but he was the first to really show this very particular neural circuit in the auditory system, these like delay line circuits to compute time differences between the ears. And I just thought this was absolutely my first introduction to neuroscience. And I thought that was fabulous. I was like, this is so cool. This is like, you know, you try to figure out what a circuit is, you actually see it in a brain, you can measure it. Sort of that marriage of like theory, computation, and neuroscience, I thought was really attractive. So I started getting more into neuroscience. I poked around a bit and ended up landing as an undergrad researcher in Christoph Koch's lab. who is well known now for his work, especially at the Allen Institute and on consciousness. But you know, there were a lot of people in his lab working on a lot of different things, mostly related to like visual perception. So that's where I really learned how to kind of do neuroimaging at a basic level and psychophysics, and worked on some fun things there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I was actually going to ask you, you know, when I was looking at your CV, I was like, oh, wow, he worked with Christof Koch. I don't think many people know that. And, you know, certainly, Chris, as you mentioned, he's become this prominent popular figure in neuroscience and even, mm-hmm. you know, the general more wider community. And he's a unique character. And I'm kind of curious what you, you know, it seems like you were working on this sort of work with under him as well. And so I'm kind of curious how that started and how it was actually, you know, interacting with him. Was he, you know, in the lab every day? Or was he, you know, was he constantly throwing out ideas or does he care about fMRI? Or
yeah, I think fMRI had always been kind of a side thing for him. He'd been having a lot of success at that time with sort of early human neurophysiology work. So he had this collaboration with Itzhak Fried, and there were a bunch of people in the lab who were working on that, which was, you know, extremely successful. They found these Jennifer Aniston neurons most famously, which was just a fabulous experiment, and I think really is still something that influences me. But yeah, so I guess I landed there working on an fMRI project that was related to auditory processing, which was something that I found fascinating still. And you know, we were looking at the brains of blind people who had been blind from birth, and how their visual cortex was repurposed for processing other senses and particularly audio information in this case. So this was all work with a postdoc, Melissa Sines, who was there, who's a fabulous researcher who really like taught me how to do fMRI and kind of taught me how to be a scientist in a very basic way, which I very, very much still appreciate. So, you know, we got some things going there. I think it was maybe not Christoph's like main focus, was like doing this sort of auditory neuroscience or auditory fMRI stuff. But it was a really fun place to be. I was just surrounded by super smart people who were like very motivated and very interesting, and I've stayed friends with a lot of people from there over the years. And I really found that to be a very like nice formative experience. So I actually ended up staying there as a master's student also. So it was kind of a fifth year in my undergraduate.
Okay. All right. Well, cool. And then you just kind of, it seems like it was a natural sort of evolution just to kind of go into Jack's lab at Berkeley. It was close by as well.
Kind of. So it was really interesting, actually. I was more into auditory neuroscience at the time. I was like, even kind of into music neuroscience. I thought that was the really kind of fun, interesting thing. And I still think it's super interesting. I just think it's hard. It's hard. hard to, I think, get funding for. It's tough in a lot of ways. But there was a moment. So Jack actually came to Caltech and gave a talk when I was just finishing up my undergrad, and he was talking about his work on macaque V2, so studying visual cortex using neurophysiology, and he gave this spiel about his natural stimulus approach. You know, I'd been learning all about basic sort of visual neuroscience. We look at Gabor filters. We very carefully construct these stimuli to test very specific hypotheses about what happens in V1, what happens in MT, et cetera. Yep. That was kind of the world of vision neuroscience that I was steeped in at that moment. Yep. So then to see Jack talk about this in this way that's like, you know, that's not really what the brain is meant to do. And like meant is a, loaded term, but you know, that's not what the brain is kind of set up to do. That's not really what it's learned to do. What it's learned to do is process real images, to process like the world around us. So his view is really, you know, we should study the brain doing what it wants to do. We should study the brain looking at natural stimuli, natural images in this case. And then we have these great computational tools. Now we can build these computational models that actually describe how the brain is processing this information. And this was just kind of revelatory to me. I you know, I still had come from this, again, like very sort of more traditional vision science background. And this just kind of blew my mind. I was like, this is the coolest thing I've ever heard. I remember just going back to the lab after that and talking to everyone like, how can we do something like this? This is so exciting. Like, you know, I want to take all this data that I have and try to figure out, you know, can we do things that are, you know, similar to this with that data? Yeah. So that moment, like that talk that Jack gave, really changed things for me. It really made me super excited about doing, in particular, that kind of work. And then I ended up, going to grad school at Berkeley.
Okay. And I have to mention your thesis is online. It's just a wonderful thesis. I mean, it's just sort of nice introduction. It's obviously a compilation of your papers, but it's just works through a lot of things and writes things in a very clear way. It's actually, and it's interesting how you know, what struck me about your work and Jack's work as well is that the neuroscience community has started out in a, you know, reductionistic sort of way and trying to build up, you know, their knowledge, you know, using, you know, classic, you know, stylized experiments that just look at attempt to isolate one thing at a time, and then they can figure things out. And most people think, okay, well, things are too uncontrolled when it's naturalistic. However, as your approach has been, well, if you do your best at extracting features from the naturalistic world as well as you can, and then put that into a model, then you can pull everything out, it seems. And that's sort of, it seems like that's the art. I mean, there's other people who are also attempting to look at naturalistic stimuli in different sort of ways. Some things like cross-subject analysis or connectivity analysis, which is also good and it has its place. But I think that, as you've done, as you write in your papers, it's sort of the idea that using as much information that you have, knowledge that you have about the stimuli, can help you inquire and map that information. So,
yeah, and I think there's something kind of more basic to the natural stimulus approach too that I find just deeply attractive. Which, you know, if you're doing these traditional experiments, you design an experiment to test a hypothesis, right? You test that hypothesis, you get a, you know, thumbs up, thumbs down, you write a paper, you're adding something to our knowledge about how this system works, right? But there's one thing that's missing there, and this sounds shallow, but it's just like, how close are you to actually understanding the system? How far is there left to go? Like, how much do you actually understand? How good is your model of what this system is actually doing? Yes. And that's something that I feel like that question is just fundamentally unanswered in standard experiments, right? And there's some sense of, you know, meta-scientifically, like how close we are is how many aspects of this thing we've tested in, you know, across many different studies, across many different papers. But with natural stimuli, when you're recording, you know, how the brain responds to natural stimuli, there's a very natural way to just measure this, which is how well can you predict how the brain responds to natural stimuli? Like, that is just, it's a quantitative measure. How close are you to understanding, in at least some sense, what this system is doing?
Yeah, right? Yeah.
So that kind of quantitation of the, you know, scientific advancement, if you will, is something that I also found very attractive, is that it turns this, what is generally a more qualitative and loosey-goosey thing of like, how much do we understand what, you know, this piece of brain is doing or how the brain is doing whatever. It turns it into just a number. And then you're like, I want this number to go up. I'm going to do things to make this number go up. I'm going to try things until this number goes up. And then when I do, I can say that, you know, this is a better model of what the system is doing than this other thing.
Yeah.
That, I just really like that too. That resonates with me. That feels good.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I totally agree with that. So there's two things. One, I might jump ahead, but two, I want to back up a little bit. But the first part before So just put a bookmark there in terms of predicting, sort of best predicting what the brain will do with stimuli. I always wonder though, so you have these maps and then the question still is, okay, so you have these maps of different dimensions of social interaction and objects and things like that. But still there's the question of, okay, so this is the organization and it looks, you know, partially ordered, partially random. But then still the question is, you know, what's actually going on? You know, what computations are going on? I mean, why is it like that? And you know, still, obviously, we need to dig down and understand and start to, you know, and I think you alluded to this in some of your papers where, you know, the neuroscience there, or the computational or the theoretical neuroscience community, you know, is trying to make models that would, you know, do those computations. And so hopefully someday we'll meet in the middle in terms of, you know, knowing what the actual computations are, knowing why the brain is distributed this way. You know, it's still, you know, it's more detail, and it's just amazing because it sort of turns, like, you know, classic language processing is, you know, specific areas, and then suddenly you have, it's kind of everywhere, and in all these different areas, and but it's not exactly random, and so that turns it on its head, but at the same time, it still at some level begs the question of, like, okay, so what's actually happening?
And so, I mean, I do think doing even this, like, quantitative modeling with natural stimuli, it doesn't give you easy answers, right? And it doesn't give you answers that map sort of easily to the kinds of things that we think of as scientific understanding more generally. So there's still, like, a lot of work to be done even after you have a model that fits the brain very well. And that's what a lot of the challenge is in this area, is saying, you know, once I have a model that works well, how do I use that to actually do science, right? How do I use that to tell me something that's useful about the brain, tell me something that's interesting about the brain, tell me something that's maybe new about the brain that I didn't know from other approaches. So that is definitely, like, the big challenge of this approach, is kind of once you have things in this nice computational setup, how do you coerce that into a, you know, scientific result?
Yeah. And so before we get into that more depth, why don't we back up and just maybe describe the Nature paper in 2016 that sort of caught my attention. Mm-hmm. If you could maybe try to encapsulate the concept of what you've done in a nutshell for those who have not read it.
Yeah, for sure. So yeah. The basic idea is we wanted to look at kind of language processing very generally using these tools that have been developed for studying the visual system. Right. So in Jack's lab, a lot of people had done a lot of work for building models, first of visual neurophysiology data, and then visual fMRI data, especially Kendrick Kay and Thomas Nasilaris and Shinji Nishimoto's work, which was really fabulous and, you know, extremely valuable, formative, that I took a lot of those ideas. And then we're just applying them kind of wholesale to language, right? Can we look in this entirely different domain, but still use these same tools? And this was also really inspired by a paper from 2008 from Tom Mitchell and Marcel Just's groups that was in Science, that was using kind of similar approaches in terms of, you know, voxel-wise modeling, fitting these regression-based encoding models, but for language. And there it was, you know, single isolated words, so it wasn't really, like, natural language, but still the fact that that approach worked for that data, I think, really gave us the kick that, like, you know, this can work for, you know, real natural language. So what we did is we did a natural language experiment. We had people lay in an MRI scanner and just listen to stories. That's our basic experiment. That's still the experiment that, you know, I'm doing in my lab today, is just lay in the scanner and listen to podcasts. It sounds silly. It's a very fun experiment to be a subject for. I have been subject for this experiment a lot. I've gotten scanned for many, 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 many hours on this kind of thing. And it's honestly pretty pleasant. I think anybody who's listening to this probably likes podcasts. So imagine just doing that, but also, you know, laying still in a loud banging tube. It's not that much worse than just listening to a podcast.
Yeah.
So we have people just listen to podcasts, right? So this is absolutely natural language. It's people telling stories about their lives. The podcast that we use are the Moth Radio Hour. Once we have this data, once we have how the brain is responding to these stories, we then try to figure out what kinds of features can we extract from the stories, what kinds of things in the stories the brain might represent or the brain might care about. We can do this in many different ways. We could look at, for example, auditory spectral information, what frequencies of sound are present, what phonemes are present in each moment. But the thing that I was really interested in is the semantic content. So, you know, what do the words mean in the stories, and how is that word meaning, or the, you know, meaning of the story, represented in brain activity, or how does that correlate with brain activity, I guess.
Yeah.
So we had all these stories. We take each word in the stories and convert that into some numerical representation that captures something about word meaning. Here we're using word embedding vectors. That paper, even though it came out in 2016, really all of the initial work on it was done in like 2013. So this was before kind of modern word embeddings were a thing. Word to Vec has become very popular in the last few years. That came out in 2014. We were using something a bit hand-rolled, but whatever. Right, so we convert each word into this vector that says, like, what is this word meaning? What is this word's meaning? This kind of, you might ask, like, what the hell are those vectors? Like, what does that look like? In practice, the only kind of important thing about those vectors is that words with similar meanings will have similar vectors, right? So, like, dog and hound will have very similar vectors in the space, while, like, dog and, I don't know, Jupiter probably don't.
And so the vector would be 1,000 points or whatever.
Yeah.
And it would sort of compare against this multidimensional space against all these other concepts or whatever. Yeah.
Right, right. And again, the only thing that matters is the kind of distances between them, or really the dot products between them. In fact, we did some work later. We didn't really realize theoretically what was going on at kind of a deep level then. We had a paper come out in, gosh, I think 2019 with Anwar Nunez as the first author, where we really did, I think, figure out like what were the key things here. And the key thing is really just what are the dot products between the word vectors? Like how similar are these word vectors to each other? And that kind of becomes a prior for the model on how similar the brain responses to those words might be, right? So if the vectors for dog and hound are very similar, then we're kind of assuming that the brain response to dog and the brain response to hound will be similar. If a part of the brain responds to the word dog, it probably also responds to the word hound.
Yeah.
So we can take all these vectors, we kind of mash them into a design matrix that, you know, involves sort of temporally downsampling things because there's many words per TR, many words per, you know, volume of the fMRI data. And then we build these big regression models that predict the responses in each voxel separately. So we have, you know, a response time course for each voxel. How does it respond across a few hours of stories? And then we're going to try to predict that time course as some linear combination of these semantic features of the, you know, the dimensions in these word vectors. And then, you know, we can test these models. So this is kind of the one of the key things about voxel-wise modeling approach. We can take new data that we didn't train the models on, so a different story. We can predict how the brain would respond to that story, right? So we can take the words of that story and then say, what would the brain response look like according to our model? And then we can look at the correlation between those predicted responses and the actual responses. And that can tell us how good our model is, in essence, right? And I think of this as, again, kind of a gold standard for a model of the brain. Like if you have a good model of what some part of the brain is doing, you should be able to predict how that part of the brain will respond to new stimuli.
Yeah. And it sort of gets around the problem of, I mean, people worry about maybe overfitting or things like that, but that this seems like it addresses that pretty directly. Yeah.
Right, right. If you overfit, it gets worse, right? If you underfit, it gets worse. If you do anything wrong, it gets worse, right?
Right.
So this is, it's a nice metric in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So it turns out that these word embedding kind of semantic features about word meaning, they do a really good job at predicting responses across a pretty wide expanse of cortex, which I think this was surprising to us in a few ways. So it's really like almost all of parietal lobe. I sometimes say it's like easier to talk about the parts of the brain that it doesn't predict well. So it's like visual cortex, somatomotor cortex, orbitofrontal and insular cortex. And that's kind of it. Everything else is really well modeled by this. Almost all of parietal lobe, most of temporal lobe, most of frontal cortex, you know, minus somatomotor.
And it's interesting. I was actually doing a little bit of research on this, and it seems that, you know, I mean, it reminded me a little bit of Daniel Margulis's sort of gradients in the brain. Like he was suggesting that, and Jeff Binder, but they never, you know, they just said, oh, semantic stuff, but then they never went into the detail and mapped it out in the way that you have. And so that's, yeah, it's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, there have been these indications, right, that like, especially from Jeff Binder's work, which I think is really good. And, you know, he has gone on and done work that is like mapping these different sort of semantic dimensions. And they do a lot of work on like defining specific semantic dimensions in an interesting way.
Yeah.
But so, you know, they found that a lot of the brain seems to respond to something semantic, right? Seems to be related to something about word meaning, but didn't have this sort of mapping of what that is. So, you know, once we have these models that do a good job at fitting these brain areas, we know that they can predict well, we can then dig into those models and say, what is it about the words that drives the responses in these brain areas?
Yes, yes.
So like, what kinds of words will make this piece of brain turn on? right? So we find things like there are a bunch of brain areas that really like words that describe numbers or numbers of things, right? Which really kind of recapitulated earlier results from especially like Ben Harvey and Serge de Molin's group that, you know, found these number representations. We see those same brain areas turn on when you hear somebody just say numbers sort of in passing in a story. There's a bunch of brain areas that really care about words for people, right? Or words describing social interactions. And these end up mapping very closely to things that other people have also discovered, like the theory of mind areas in the TPJ. And then, I don't know, many other things. I don't know how much detail you want me to go into.
That's perfect. And so, I mean, that summary brings to mind, you know, all kinds of questions that come up. I mean, the methodology is just amazing. Well, my first question is, why aren't more people doing this? And obviously, we'll talk maybe a little bit about sharing software and things like that. And it seems like you just wrote a paper about how you're sharing the data set. But but also, I mean, a lot of questions come to mind. Like one is, you know, how do different subjects look? I mean, for instance, if you're comparing, you're doing individual subjects, then it'd be interesting. And I'm sure you've done this many times as far as like, you know, how do different subjects look? Is there any relationship between this organization and any features of the subject, or like their you know, intelligence or their state or whatever? You know, how does this change with learning? You know, things like this are just
great
wide
questions.
Open.
Yeah. So some of those questions are kind of easier to answer, right? So how do different subjects look? This is a thing that we've spent a lot of ink and time on. You know, in general, we see that I think it really matches what we know about the brain otherwise. So it's not surprising in a way, but nice to see. Everybody has more or less the same parts. Right? Everybody has more or less the same collection of areas. They're not necessarily arranged exactly the same way. Sometimes you know, some areas are bigger and some people smaller and some people. We do also see some things that make me very specifically wary of approaches where you might map different people's brains into the same space and try to average that way. So, you know, a common assumption of these alignment methods is that there's some like diffeomorphism between different subjects' brains, right? So that's like assuming that everybody's map can be aligned by just kind of mushing it around a little bit, right? Like squeezing some parts to make them smaller, stretching some parts to make them bigger, maybe like twisting things a little bit. But in general, there's kind of this one-to-one-ish mapping that you can find through some methods, which I think is, you know, it's a fair assumption in general, because I don't think it's easy to fit anything other than diffeomorphic mappings between brains. But we see a lot of instances where that does not seem to hold in these semantic maps, right? So in general, people do have mostly the same areas and broadly the same arrangement. But we definitely see examples of like areas that are duplicated or triplicated in some subjects. So there's like different sort of numbers of repeats of these areas, or where you might have, I don't really know how to describe this verbally, but you know, you have four areas next to each other. In some people, it's like, you know, the left and right ones are sitting right next to each other. And in some people, the top and bottom ones are sitting right next to each other. So it's sort of bridging in one axis or the other. And that kind of thing we see very often. So, you know, there are definitely a lot of commonalities between subjects, but then also these little differences that, again, make me wary of subject averaging approaches.
Yeah. And I totally agree with that. I mean, I've always been a little bit wary as far as, you know, trying to morph people and, you know, even parcelating the brain. I mean, there's certainly a huge amount of heterogeneity in there. And so then the question is, you know, is it like, looking at ocular dominance columns where it seems like it's random, or is it still, I mean, it seems quasi-random, but there still might be some reason in terms of you know, why it's that particular configuration or tortuosity or whatever.
Yeah,
which is fascinating in itself.
Yeah, totally. So that gets to one of the downsides of this kind of natural stimuli encoding model approach. So you know, we need a lot of data to fit these models. So for this 2016 paper, we had people scanned for about 2 hours each. So it was like two sessions of just listening to stories and then one or two sessions of localizers and anatomicals and all this stuff, right? So that's like quite a bit of scanning for each subject. You know, in our more recent experiments, we go up to like 20 sessions per subject, which is like far beyond, you know, reasonable, normal things to do with people. But what this means is that it's very hard for us to get large samples of subjects in this approach, right? It ends up being just prohibitively expensive and just time consuming. Like it's annoying. It's difficult. whereas, you know, if you had a protocol that was, you know, one session of scanning for a subject, then it's much easier to kind of roll through many, many subjects with that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So this means that we have a lot of difficulty, I think, in answering these individual differences questions, right? Yeah. We have small samples fundamentally, right? This 2016 paper was 7 subjects. Kendrick Kay's 2008 Nature paper was 2 subjects. We just had our you know, decoding paper that came out earlier this year was 3 main subjects where we had a lot of data. It's hard to do these things in a lot of people. So we really just kind of can't answer some of these questions yet. And I don't know what the future kind of looks like for that. Are we going to just collect this kind of data in a lot more people, or I don't know what we're going to do there.
Well, one way, I mean, right. I mean, it would be also interesting to just take one subject and, you know, scan them longitudinally and, you know, see, you know, how things configure differently when they go to college and, or, you know, any sort of major life event or things like that, that you can imagine.
Yeah. So like a long-term within subject design, that would be interesting. I think the only longitudinal data we have right now is like my brain, because I've been scanning this stuff for like 10 years, but weird case study, maybe.
Yeah, that could be interesting. I mean, there's so many also interesting findings that you seem to suggest from this. And one is, I mean, I was just reading the one where you did something similar with the cerebellum, and and you know, it looks like large swaths of cerebellum are involved with social cognition and language. And
yeah, this really surprised me. So this is really driven by Amanda LaBelle, who was my RA at the time. She collected like just astonishing amounts of data while she was an RA in my lab. She's now a PhD student at Berkeley, working with Jack and also with Rich Ivory, who is a real cerebellum guy. So she got really into cerebellum when she was working in my lab. She was like, why don't we look at this stuff in the cerebellum? We have a lot of cerebellum data, actually, because it just happens to be inside our scan volumes. We've never looked at it. So let's see what's going on there. And it turns out that these models that we're fitting work quite well in cerebellum, which honestly surprised me quite a bit early on. I did not know very much about cerebellum when we started going down that path. I always thought of it as like, it's the little, you know, it just kind of tweaks timing of things. It's a motor area, like whatever. It's not. It turns out it's very deeply involved in cognition, it seems. So there's been a lot of work in the past few years on this sort of cognitive cerebellum idea. And people have really found that, especially the lateral parts of the cerebellum, these big kind of wings of the cerebellum, are really heavily kind of cognitive. They're involved in cognitive tasks and not the standard kind of motor stuff that we think of as cerebellum. In a way, like, this kind of isn't surprising that this works, as I learn more about cerebellum, which in a lot of ways, cerebellum just reflects cortex. You know, it's not like a one-to-one mapping in any kind of way, but kind of most things that happen in cortex seem to also happen in cerebellum. Like, they're very heavily interconnected. So given that, you know, we can predict, half of cortex in how it responds to these stories, we should probably be able to predict cerebellum reasonably well. And we can, it turns out. There is sort of semantic mapping in the cerebellum too. So there's different sub areas there that respond sort of selectively to different types of words, or when people are thinking about different types of concepts. We found in particular this thing that there seemed to be overrepresentation in the cerebellum of social kind of concepts. So, you know, hearing about people and their relationships and et cetera. And again, I found that kind of surprising, but again, you know, there is actually quite a big literature on cerebellum and social cognition. And for example, the cerebellum's relationship to autism or autism-like symptoms in people who have cerebellar damage. Yeah. Which again, I didn't know about. I'm you know, still kind of a cerebellum neophyte, but that was exciting to see.
That's interesting. That's actually, I mean, right. Exactly. What, I mean, and so it's, and you look at the structure of the cerebellum, people wonder what the cerebellum is actually, you know, people can be born without a cerebellum and they seem like they're functioning. Maybe you're right. Maybe they're slightly autistic or, but yeah, you're wondering, you know, we're still trying to figure that out. And also, I was also surprised, you have a recent paper where you did a decoding of phonetic features, and you broke down words into, you know, their phenomes and whatever, and compared that with semantic. And I was actually surprised with how close to the auditory cortex, you'd think that that was just purely phonetic, breaking down into formants or whatever, but it was also, you know, very close to the primary auditory cortex was also semantic encoding as well. Very cool.
So I kind of believe this result, right? That we found representation of semantic features runs kind of right up to where auditory cortex begins, right? So right up to the spirio-temporal gyrus. We have some work on this more recently that I think paints more specific pictures. So we have now much better models of the sort of lower level auditory processing. And you know, this is, I think, a neat success of a more recent approach, which is we get this from looking at these large neural network models, right? So in the past, what we could do was we could get features from the stimuli that we knew how to label, right? So this relied on hypotheses that we had, feature extraction methods that people had, right? So we can look at the frequencies of sound that are present, so the loudness of different frequencies, which phonemes are present, which are things that, you know, linguists care about a lot, and then these word level properties. But more recently, we've really found that when you have neural network models that are trained to do things with stimuli, to do things with language or do things with vision, if you extract the representations from inside these neural networks, that those are outrageously effective, much more effective than our hand-designed feature spaces at predicting, you know, responses in pretty much all of cortex. Like the neural network models just are wildly outclassing everything that we had before. Especially on this question of kind of auditory cortex, what is the organization around there? We really see, if we look at a specific neural network model that's trained to just process speech, we do see this nice kind of feature gradient from early auditory cortex up, you know, laterally out to the spirio-temporal sulcus, of increasing complexity of these features, which I think what we saw before in terms of like phonemes and semantics, this was a low dimensional shadow of this sort of higher dimensional reality, that there was this more continuous progression of feature complexity as you move across cortex.
What are the implications as far as that's concerned? Why it fits well and it works really well. And I think you had a paper related to this. Does it mean that the brain is just sort of all we're really doing is just predicting the next word? So, right. I mean, because that works well.
What does that mean?
Exactly.
Yeah, this has been a big question, right? So us and a few other groups, especially Ev Fedorenko's group at MIT, Uri Hassan's group at Princeton, and Jean-Remy King's group in Paris, have really been pushing on this sort of neural network language models as a model of language processing cortex. So for people who aren't aware, these language models, this is things like GPT, the basis of ChatGPT, these are big, you know, generic neural network models. They could learn to fit any function, but they're trained to predict the next word in a piece of text from the previous words, right? So they're very explicitly kind of autoregressive models. And the kind of magic thing about these neural networks, and this is something that was really kind of discovered in the, you know, natural language processing machine learning community, is that when you train a model to do this, when you train a model to just predict the next word, that objective is just very deeply useful. Like that objective covers a lot of ground. In order to predict the next word in text well, you have to do a lot of stuff, and you have to do a lot of stuff well. You have to not just know, you know, what are nouns and the fact that, you know, you say a determiner like a or the before a noun, or, you know, adjectives usually become before nouns in English, but you also have to know, you know, what kinds of adjectives might be applied to dogs, or what kinds of adjectives might be applied to trees. You also kind of, you know, to get really good at this, you need to know kind of how the world works.
Yes.
Right? These models have to build some internal model of the world in order to just effectively predict the next word in text.
Right. So that's interesting.
This is really, you know, if you've used ChatGPT, you know that it's pretty good at a lot of things. It understands a lot of things about the world. And all of that, it's really just learned from trying to predict the next word in a piece of text, right? So this is an incredibly effective objective, right? So, you know, in the natural language processing computer science world, people found that this was just a useful, they called it a pre-training objective. You train a neural network model to do this, and then you can repurpose it for doing anything else, right? So there used to be all these sort of custom models built for solving different language problems. Now everything kind of goes through a language model first, and then you do something with that afterward. So, applying that same kind of idea to these encoding models for the brain, you feed the language that somebody is hearing into one of these neural network models, you extract the representations from inside the model, from some layer of the model, you use those to predict the brain, and it does a fabulous job at predicting brain activity. So there was a push kind of early on in this era to argue that this is really evidence that the brain is learning to do the same kind of thing that the neural network model does, right? That because the neural network model that was trained on this next word prediction autoregressive objective predicts the brain so well, that means that the brain might also be trained on that autoregressive kind of next word prediction objective. And this is an attractive idea because it really mirrors ideas of predictive coding, which is a very nice theory that seems to explain a lot of things, including this. Right?
Yes.
So there were a bunch of papers that kind of argued this. I'm pretty skeptical of this conclusion. I think it's really hard to actually nail down. And I think one of the problems is that, or the key problem, is that next word prediction is not a unique way to arrive at these representations, right? Yeah. That these are representations that are useful for a bunch of other tasks.
Yeah.
So if you learn to do other tasks, you also arrive at representations that are useful in some of the same ways as next word prediction, maybe not as generically. So we had a paper last year, my student RJ Antonello, where we had some fun, like reductio ad absurdum version of this, which was you take a neural network model that's trained to translate English to German. It turns out that how well that model does at a bunch of other tasks really predicts how well those tasks model the brain. This was similar to the argument that people made around these predictive models. But of course, we don't think that subjects' brains are fundamentally translating things into German. Like, we don't think that that's the fundamental thing that's happening here. None of the subjects we scan knew German. It just happens that, that's another objective that learns a lot of the same kind of stuff. It learns this kind of structure.
Yes.
So I don't want to say it's not predictive coding, but just I've kind of become skeptical that there's an easy way to falsify predictive coding as a hypothesis.
Right.
In space.
Right. Right. Yeah. I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying. And you're right. There are other ways of arriving at that, like you said, through sort of just experience. You might argue that there's, flavors of predictive coding for other things, and that you're sort of, it gets into a realm of how specific you want to get in terms of defining predictive coding. And then, but either way, I mean, the fact that it works, and the fact that it works very well is just incredible. And it sort of does say something for the power of at least doing that. I wanted to back up just a little bit. There's many people probably listening to this, and the lab I'm in as well sort of pioneered sort of identifying areas like the face area, or mm-hmm. the idea, aside from, obviously primary visual cortex, the primary cortices sort of feed into these areas, but there's a face area that seems like it defies in some sense the idea that, sort of this just, are there other like small face areas throughout the brain, or is there, it's like they generally find this face area. Maybe that sort of takes a special place to evolution as being very important, but how does that merge with this semantic space as far as the rest of the brain is concerned?
that's a great question. So this is something that we think about a lot, obviously, right? So we have these results that are, we think they are true. We think they're telling us things about the brain. They just look very different from how, other results are presented in neuroscience, the other things that people have found.
Yeah.
In a way, these things have to be concordant, or probably are concordant, because I don't think anybody's doing anything wrong. Like, I don't think any of the inferences we're making here are necessarily like wrong about how the brain's working. The data are the data, right? And the data show what the data show. So it's a matter of kind of finding, how are these things compatible? And in general, we found, I had some work before we got into language on fitting these same kinds of models to look at semantic maps in vision using natural movies. Yeah. And what we found there was these nice semantic maps kind of across higher visual cortex. And that was always consistent with the sort of known visual areas, right?
Yeah.
So we'd find that, you know, the face areas, the place areas, the body areas, like they're all consistent. They do really respond to those things in natural stimuli, right? The face area really loves it when you see somebody's face, especially when you see somebody's face like in motion. That ends up being really wonderfully good at driving these areas. The body areas really do like seeing people, you know, running, doing athletic things, et cetera. But I think what we see more is that like these areas are not necessarily kind of isolated islands in a broader sea of God knows what schmoo, but that these areas are really part of this larger structure, right? That kind of across higher visual cortex, there's a lot of brain areas that are selective for a lot of things. A lot of them are kind of weirder. So we see some, you know, animal selective areas, et cetera. But that these things all kind of run into each other in this broader map that, you know, has these consistent parts like the face areas, et cetera.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I mean, there could be this hierarchy, and it just happens to be that, right. I mean, there's, and also, so you had a paper showing a lot, these maps are sort of modality independent. So you could have auditory or you didn't necessarily do sensory, but auditory and visual, and they seem to sort of merge. They seem to, you know, come from the sensory areas and merge into the, you know, some sort of central area where they're adjacent to each other, and which sort of speaks to a really an amazing organizational principle.
I love that paper. I think that might be just like my favorite paper that I've ever worked on. So this is work that was led by Sarah Popham, who was a grad student in Jack's lab at Berkeley. It was, and I think this is a really cool result about cortex and about organization of cortex. And I think generalizing this idea has been really interesting for us. So, you know, we had all this data from people listening to stories. It turns out we had also collected data on those same people because they're, you know, lab members, whatever, watching natural movies. So we asked, like, how are these things related? So I'd done some basic analyses of this long time ago, where we just looked for kind of correlations, right? Are there voxels that are correlated, that, you know, do the same thing, respond to the same stuff in movies and stories? And yeah, we found a collection of those voxels that are, you know, correlated. It's sort of scattered around the edge of visual cortex. That's fine. And, you know, digging through the literature, a lot of people have shown that in a lot of different ways, right? There have been sort of ROI-wise studies where people look at face selective ROIs, then words for faces, and it turns out that, you know, words for faces activate, you know, visual face selective areas. People have done it with MBPA. People have done it with whatever, any method that comes along. People are you know, looking at the same question, which I think is a very basic question, right? Like words for things, images for things, like, are they related in the brain? And I thought, okay, this is, we're not really seeing anything new. This is fine. But then as part of my 2016 language paper, I made this online viewer for this data set. So this is really fun, and I encourage anyone listening to try this out. It's at, I think, gallantlab.org/hooth2016. Yeah. So it's this 3D, you know, viewer of the brain, and you can click on different voxels and see what those voxels are selected for, right? See what like the best words for these voxels are. Just kind of exploring the data, seeing like what's happening in there. And one thing that I found there that was just kind of surprising, kind of odd, was just outside of PPA, just outside of the parahippocampal place area, which is a, you know, well-known area that really responds to, you know, images of buildings and 3D scenes kind of more generally, et cetera. So there were these responses that seemed very specific to kind of place words. So things like, you know, parking lot, office, street, et cetera. And it wasn't like in PPA, it was right next to PPA. It was like right on the edge of PPA.
Yeah.
And I thought, this is kind of weird. This is kind of interesting. And, you know, I looked around and saw similar things for the occipital place area, OPA, retrosplenial complex, RIC, which are the other two like well-known place areas. And it was like, this seems like a pattern that there's this kind of related, you know, representation of language and vision. So we dug into that more deeply. And what we found was, yeah, this really lovely pattern of, you know, you have this visual area that's very much responsive to images related to a category, just in front of that. So always like anterior, just sort of outside visual cortex of these areas, because all of these high level visual areas really fall like along the boundary of visual cortex. So just outside those areas, there would be a patch of cortex that really responded to the same concepts, but in language. Okay. And these two things would actually overlap. There'd be just a tiny little overlap where they're, you know, there's a few voxels where, you know, they respond to both, you know, words for places and images for places. So what we saw there was that, you know, all these things that people had seen using these other methods of concordant representations of vision and language, they were seeing these little boundary voxels, the ones that were shared. But what they weren't seeing was this larger context where you had the two areas kind of sitting next to each other, the visual area and the language area, that are just kind of overlapping. You have this little gradient between them. And that was so cool. That was like such a fun result. You know, so then we found this first for visual, for the place areas, and then we looked more deeply at, you know, does this happen for other categories? And it seems like it does. In fact, it seems like it does kind of all around the edge of visual cortex. So visual cortex has this rim, and all around that rim, there's these kind of matching language and visual representations.
That is very cool. I mean, that's, I mean, it sort of intuitively makes sense, but the fact that it exists, and the question is how does it form, and what's actually going on there, is so cool. I mean, there's things like that that are coming out of your work, like that make you, you know, makes one pause and think, try to think more deeply about how, you know, once again, going back to how, you know, what's going on, we're mapping something going on here, and, you know, how can we even dig a little bit further? And that's along those lines. How much more detail do you think one would want? I mean, how much more detail does it go? Like, let's say you had an fMRI resolution that was, you know, 0.1 millimeter voxels or less than that, with infinite signal to noise. I mean, would the patterns, I mean, certainly they would get better, but would there be anything new? Or do you think that there's this sort of like fractal, like, you know, like where they become even more interdigitated the further down you go? Or
So I think that's totally plausible, right? And we kind of know that from people who have looked at visual cortex, like bold responses versus neurophysiology. I'm thinking of Tanaka's work here, where you know, if you look at individual neurons within a voxel that seems to be selective for something, on average, those neurons are selective for that thing. But what each individual neuron does is actually pretty different. They can be quite heterogeneous. It's just this sort of general property. Which is what they found in IT. But then, you know, contra that is like Doris Sow's work, where she's found that, you know, if you find face selective patch of cortex, you put a probe in there, every neuron cares about faces, right? So there does seem to be some difference across different brain areas, maybe in terms of, you know, how consistent the neurons are, how homogeneous each area is. And I think that would be really interesting to know, like, why are some brain areas like that and others not? I would love to know the answer to that. Maybe it's like, if you're looking at the right stimuli, they look homogeneous. If you're not, they look heterogeneous. Like that's possible.
Yeah.
The thing that I would really like to see if we had, you know, much higher resolution fMRI data, would be more laminar specificity. I know something that, you work on in your group too. That would be fantastically interesting. I think that's, you know, looking at just sort of higher resolution across cortex where things are, there might be interesting things that come out there. There might not, like, we don't know, maybe the maps just look the same, but smoother, whatever.
I mean, there's always a chance you can get, you know, what area is talking to which area is feeding back. And that might help inform some models, at least in some sense. But you're right. I mean, okay. So that would be good. I mean, what about the temporal resolution as far as, you know, certainly you're smearing, you're losing some power in terms of, you know, the hemodynamic response and, you know, trying to fit these models to something that's sort of a smeared hemodynamic response. But it works though. And did you ever try using, you know, thinking of using like, you know, simultaneous EEG or or looking at MEG with a time lock stimulus and then, you know, going back, you know?
Yeah. No, that's interesting. So we've done some EEG fMRI experiments, not simultaneous, but the same subjects listen to the same stimuli in EEG and fMRI. Separately, which is much easier to do and is fine if you just care about like stimulus response relationships from the part. Right. I don't have a good answer for you there. What's going on? It's hard to build models that relate those two in natural stimuli, it turns out. We're also working on collecting a kind of matched fMRI MEG data set with Leila Wahebe at CMU, where we're trying to get subjects to listen, not the same subjects in this case, but different subjects, listen to many hours of stories, again, with fMRI and with MEG, and then to build models that could relate these two, or you know, use the fMRI to get the spatial resolution and MEG to get the temporal resolution to really lock down things that are going on. And I'm very interested to see where that goes. I don't really know where it's going to go yet. In terms of, you know, fMRI faster sampling, like I don't think there's a huge benefit there. It seems to be, this is maybe a little in the methods weeds, but I feel like there's one kind of qualitative jump that you get as you go faster with fMRI, which is when you unalias the heartbeat signal from the brain signal, right? That's that's the thing. So you know, heartbeat typically around 60 BPM, give or take, right? So you get about one heartbeat per second. If your TR then is kind of a multiple of 1 second, so you know, 1 second, 2 second, 3 second, you're going to get this heartbeat signal aliased to around 0 hertz. And so it really like munges things up in a way that's very hard to disentangle. But if you go faster than that, if you get down to like half second TR, then that heartbeat signal actually gets, you know, pushed out to where it should be at about 1 hertz. And that denoising seems to really actually help things a decent amount. I think the costs currently in terms of resolution, coverage, whatever, of going to, you know, 500 millisecond TR are still pretty extreme, or extreme enough that we haven't gone that route yet. We're still sitting at like 2 seconds and just kind of pushing resolution instead. But I think that's where the kind of qualitative improvement there is. I will say though, you know, some of the stuff we're doing recently, I really think there's a lot more kind of fast information, high temporal resolution information in fMRI than people give it credit for. I think people have really underestimated what you can get out of fMRI. I've been, you know, talking to people about this for a long time. I think the best demonstration of this was really Shinji Nishimoto's movie decoding paper from 2011. So this was from Jack's lab. Shinji, you know, had people watch natural videos, and then he could actually decode those videos with reasonable accuracy, right? So things that are like motion, you know, it's fabulous what he could do. And I think I don't know why people didn't look at that result and actually think about it, because it really, I mean, says to you that you can see these fast things with fMRI, right? You can see things that are, you know, quickly moving, you know, fast kind of stuff. The key is that you have to demodulate those things. So you have to find a variable that says whether a fast thing is happening, and that variable itself becomes a slow thing. Right. So actually tracking some motion is fast, but having a variable that says there was motion of this type, that is slow.
Right?
And that's the thing that ends up being really key. So, you know, I think we're exploiting this a lot in our recent work. So we had this you know, decoding paper that came out recently where we can decode stories that somebody's listening to or even thinking with reasonable, I think, shocking accuracy for fMRI. And we're getting like whole phrases, right? We're getting a lot of words correct. We're getting things that kind of should not be there if you think about what the temporal resolution of fMRI, what the, you know, what the kind of limits of bold are. But I think the key thing there is, again, that we've taken this fast thing, which is, you know, what are the words happening in the sequence, and we've turned it into a slow thing, which is this vector from a neural network language model that kind of bundles up all that information. It says, like, did this kind of phrase occur? And so you can use that to figure this out.
Well, the phrase more, happens at a slower time scale, and so you can actually get,
Exactly. More recently, so we can actually take these models that we fit, these like neural network based models, and we can simulate ECOG experiments. So we, we take these models that we fit, you know, to individual fMRI voxels, and then the models are really operating on sound at like a 100 hertz scale. So we can simulate, you know, what does the model kind of think the underlying neural activity is at like a 100 hertz scale instead of the, you know, 0.5 hertz scale of the fMRI response. And when we do this, when we try to replicate existing ECOG experiments, we can actually do that pretty well. Like shockingly well.
So what are the assumptions as far as that's concerned? I mean, as far as, so that's interesting. You're just looking at the fMRI response that you should basically encoding the fMRI response with these higher frequency responses, and then you can actually infer those from the fMRI response. It's somehow unique in that regard.
Yeah, it doesn't end up being like exactly unique. So there's certainly like limits on what kinds of things we can say. For example, we definitely can't say that like this area responded before this area. That kind of order information is just completely lost in fMRI. But to say what kinds of features this area responds to, what is the time scale of this area? That's one that we've been able to replicate very nicely to time scales of 100 milliseconds. We can see areas that have temporal context sensitivity of 100 milliseconds versus 500 milliseconds versus a second, even though all of those things are like way outside the band that we can see with bold fMRI. Yes. So I think there's a lot of exciting stuff to be done on like pushing what we can get out of fMRI with big computational models.
That's very cool. I totally agree with you too. I think I'm glad that you say that as well, because there's people are ready to talk about the limitations, but if you're clever, right, you can build models of what the fMRI is sensitive to and then pull that out. And it's not that many assumptions as far as that's concerned. I totally agree with that. And even looking at things like transients and habituation or other sort of nonlinear responses, it can be done as well. So.
Sure, which of course, I mean, that's a kind of classic fMRI thing, and that is definitely giving you access to something that is faster than the bold response.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Okay, so that's actually a very positive picture as far as how you're going. Two last questions. So, I've often thought, it's along the lines, you mentioned decoding of the movie, and, people are trying to work with resting states. And I, as I was reading your papers, I'm thinking, okay, if you make this entire, with an individual subject, it takes a lot of time, but if you make an entire map of almost every voxel in the brain is sort of something related to a semantic content or something related to some sort of perception or whatever, couldn't you invert that and then look at resting state and sort of like, at a time point by time point basis, sort of, even during resting state, just read out.
What are you thinking about?
What's going on? Right.
Yeah. So we've talked about this a lot actually with regards to our decoding. This would definitely be possible. We can plug in any data we get from the subject to our decoding model. So, we showed that we can plug in data that we got while somebody was watching a silent movie and we can decode what was happening in the movie from that. That works well. I have no doubt that this would do something with resting state data. But the thing that we haven't landed on there is, while it sounds fun, like for one, how would we tell whether it works, whether it's actually getting out what the subject is thinking? There's ways to get that. We could elicit responses from the subject, have them narrate their thoughts, but then it's not really a resting state, right? There's other things we could do. But then also like, I'm just not sure what the value of that is. Like we get a decent amount of pushback on decoding stuff, not from neuroscientists, but from kind of the public.
Yeah.
People saying like,
yes,
this is just scary. Like, why are you doing this? And, I think fundamentally we're doing it to, for one, to just study how the brain processes language. For two, I think this potentially could help people, right? So it could help people who have communication difficulties, not probably with fMRI, but if we could replicate this in near-infrared spectroscopy or diffuse optical tomography, that would be something that could maybe end up as a product that people could use. I've seen a lot of response to our work that's just like, this is leading to the thought police, like don't do this. So we've talked to ethicists in the space. We've talked to people who work on like neuroethics, and generally their response has been, you should absolutely do this, and you should absolutely even do the things that we find kind of icky, because what the sort of ethicists and eventually policymakers need is knowledge about like what is possible,
right? And what are the limits? I mean, to say, hey, look, we really can't do this. I mean, you think you can do this, but this is what we can actually do, which is not really brain reading or mind reading or whatever.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I think it is important to do that kind of thing. But so we haven't really settled on a way to look at like resting state decoding. We are broadly interested in kind of, how far can we go with just like decoding fleeting thoughts, random thoughts that you have, maybe reactions you have to something, because that is not something that it seems like our decoder can currently get, but is that something we could adapt it to get? We're not sure. And it's harder to study too.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really hard. And also, you're right. I mean, in terms of what are the applications, I mean, it is interesting. You know, there might be a lot of other things going on in resting state that are below your consciousness. And so what's that? Mm-hmm. So, and that could also be an interesting thing to study in that sense. But it sort of leads to the question of, so what do you think would be the clinical applications of this potentially? Pre-surgical mapping, you can imagine surgeons would be extra careful in terms of where, but you can imagine other things too, like be able to predict behavior or recovery or things like that. So,
yeah. So most clinical applications, it kind of falls into this trap that we talked about before of like individual differences, or like, does this tell us something about the person? Does this tell us something about like a person's disease state, for example? And we just don't really have the tools to answer that yet. Yeah. So I think we haven't been able to really attack that, you know, type of fMRI. The direct application of decoders sort of as a tool for people to speak, I think that is kind of an obvious one that's straightforward. Right? So a lot of people are working on language brain-computer interfaces, BCIs, for example, people who have locked-in syndrome or ALS, right, where they've lost the ability to speak but are cognitively still, you know, completely functional. It's just the connection between brain and body is broken some way that you can replace that with this kind of a speech prosthesis. Yeah. So, you know, there's a lot of good work happening there with intracranial devices, which seem very effective at that. Our stuff, the thing that we're kind of excited about, and we're, you know, talking to people about this, talking to stroke aphasia researchers about this, but we haven't really gotten into trying things yet, is the possibility that this could help people with certain types of aphasia, where you know, they're still cognitively aware, cognitively capable of thinking of what they want to say. Yeah. They're capable of moving their mouth to say words, right? That connection is not broken, but there's something in between those things that's broken, right? So this is expressive, or like Broca's aphasia, where you have the thoughts, you can say words, but you can't really like glue these things together. You can't produce the sentences that you want to produce. Yeah. So current kind of speech prosthetics like can't solve that problem because they act on motor cortex, right? They look at how is motor cortex, what is it doing? But I think our semantic decoder could do that, right? Yeah. It could help because we're really looking at like, what is the idea? What is the idea that you're thinking of right now? Can we turn that into words?
Yeah.
So I think that's an exciting thing. And we're, again, trying to pursue this. I think that could be fun.
That's very cool. That's very cool. Right. Using that extra information that you have, that's exciting. I mean, there's so many avenues along those lines. So I think you're doing amazing work, and I just hope that that it can spread a little bit more in terms of the brain mapping community, because I think it's fundamentally creative and unique and penetrating in terms of understanding the brain itself. So I think we'll end it there. One last question that people like to know is, like, you know, do you have any advice for new researchers or even old researchers who are either trying to get into this or get started or whatever?
One thing I would say for new researchers, and this is advice that I give to all sort of early grad students and undergrads, take a signal processing class. It'll help you. It's I think a thing that is, it's sort of a, you know, dark horse of, you know, neuroimaging, data analysis, whatever. Just get a better understanding of signal processing, because that is really core fundamental to a lot of the things that we do, and actually understanding what the processes are, and really fundamentally in a lot of like fMRI pre-processing as well, is like understanding signal processing really helps know what's going on. You make choices about what things you do. Understanding MRI in general is kind of a signal processing, you know, the MRI physics are really fundamentally based on sort of signal processing ideas. So that's just a thing that I push everyone to do. Like that's a good entree into a lot of this stuff. I'll also say that, you know, a thing that's happening with this natural stimulus sort of approach, natural stimulus world, one of the really cool things about this approach is that you're not locked into asking one scientific question by your experiment, right? That's the more traditional, you know, cognitive psychology experiments. Well, you have the hypothesis, you design the experiment to test the hypothesis, you collect the data, and then you really can't do much beyond that, right? Your data answers that one question that you had, maybe some other related questions if you're careful about things. But for the most part, data is not terribly reusable, right? I think resting state really kind of flipped that paradigm first, right? That like you can collect this very, you know, generic data from anyone and then analyze it in a bunch of different ways and look at a lot of things. And people have done really fabulous stuff with these detailed analyses of resting state data, like Rodrigo Braga's work. I love it. And you know, just getting into these really tiny details of resting state networks that it's just there. It's just a matter of like looking at the resting state data in the right way. So I think the natural stimulus data is much the same, right? That like it's incredibly rich. You can do a lot with it, right? It doesn't have a question baked in. You have to hypothesize. You know, later, you have to form hypotheses about what the brain is doing, then test those by building models, et cetera. So I think one really nice thing about that is that there's kind of now grown up this ecosystem of data sets and sort of code libraries for doing this kind of modeling, right? So people release these big natural stimulus data sets, and then anybody can work on those and anybody can ask new questions with that data. So I think there's a lot of really good data out there now. One, I think, really fabulous example is the Natural Scenes data set, the NSD, from Kendrick Kay and Thomas Nasleris, that is super high quality, 7 Tesla fMRI data of people, like a few subjects looking at thousands of images. It's really fabulous. There's been a ton of good work done on that by other people who just use the released data. There's a great language data set released by Ari Hassan's group, and Sam Nastasi, I think, really led that, this narratives data set. I think John Hale also has a data set of people listening to like Little Prince, Christophe Pallier's work in France. So there's a lot of these big natural stimulus data sets out there. We've just released one kind of recently. So we had this paper in Scientific Data just this summer where released data for a bunch of subjects listening to 5 hours of stories and then a few subjects listening to like 16 hours of stories.
Wow. Okay.
So it's quite a bit of data for a few people. We've kind of picked the low-hanging fruit from that data, but there's a ton left. Yeah. There's so much that could be done with that, right? Yeah. So I really, if people are interested in this kind of thing, I think in a lot of ways, there's a much lower barrier to entry than there is with other areas of cognitive neuroscience, cognitive psychology, right? You don't have to have $50,000 to collect fMRI data. You don't have to have an MRI center. You don't have to have, an IRB to work with subjects or patients. You just download this data and run some stuff on it. And I think that's super cool. So I recommend if people are interested in this kind of thing, look up these data sets, try to do some things with them. It's fun.
Yeah. And you're right. I mean, that data is amazing because, right. I mean, it's not only just, the stimuli, but you can actually look at the stimuli in very many different ways, different contexts. You can try to extract different features and the feature space is just huge. And,
right.
Yeah. It's great. That is really great. I'm excited to see, who will take a crack at that and how they'll advance the field. That's great advice too. And the signal processing advice is I totally agree with that. I feel like brushing up on my signal processing myself. Okay. This was awesome. And I really appreciate you coming on. Yeah.
Thanks so much for having me, Peter. This is a lot of fun.
Yeah. And, yeah, good luck with everything in the future.
Thank you. Thank you.
Comes out next. So, all right, thanks.
Neurosalience is brought to you by the Organization for Human Brain Mapping. This week's episode was produced by Alfie Wine and Jeff Mensch.